Jesse's time.
I like to have an audience where you have to look for a seat. It's much better than having a lot of empty seats. Thank you all for coming out today. I'm Ken Sullivan, and on behalf of the West Virginia Humanities Council, I welcome you to the historic McFarland Hubbard House. I see some new faces here, so I hope you'll take time to look the place over before you leave. Welcome as well to our last little lecture for the 2015 season. We appreciate the continued financial support of our sponsors, Robinson and McElwee, attorneys at law. And I would remind you that we have refreshments after the lecture, so please plan to stay for that. We thank Jennifer Soule for providing voluntarily our refreshments for many years now. I really appreciate that. Our speaker today is Dr. Stephen McBride. He's an archaeologist who has worked primarily in the Ohio Valley region since the mid-1970s, including a good deal of work in the Greenbrier Valley of West Virginia. He grew up in Virginia, in West Virginia, and has a BA in anthropology from Beloit College and an MA and PhD in anthropology from Michigan State University. Dr. McBride works mostly in the area of military archaeology. He is particularly interested in the Civil War and frontier settlement periods. He's the Director of Interpretation and Archaeology at Camp Nelson Civil War Heritage Park in Kentucky, for which he authored a successful National Register of Historic Places and a National Historic Landmarks nomination. He also co-manages McBride Preservation Services, LLC. Much of his Camp Nelson work is focused on the site's African-American story, including both the soldiers known as the U.S. Colored Troops and their families. Dr. McBride has directed many excavations on historic sites, including work on West Virginia's frontier forts since 1990. His research in West Virginia includes archaeology and preservation planning at Civil War, Revolutionary War, and French and Indian War sites. He has helped locate sites, the first step to site preservation. You gotta find them before you can save them. Many of his excavations have been in partnership with his wife, Dr. Kim McBride, also with us, White Sulphur Springs native who is here today. Recently, they were supported by a Humanities Council grant to study the broader frontier defensive systems of several neighborhoods in Greenbrier County, placing those forts within a context of community defense. This work included included archaeological excavations, public outreach, and community with community groups and schools, and publication of a booklet distributed widely to libraries and civic organizations. Our speaker has authored or co-authored numerous articles for journals and edited volumes and technical reports. He has also co-authored Frontier Forts of West Virginia with Kim McBride and Greg Adamson, Seizing Freedom, Archaeology of Escaped Slaves at Camp Nelson, Kentucky with Kim McBride, and Frontier Defense, Colonizing Contested Areas in the Greenbrier Valley of West Virginia with Kim McBride. Dr. McBride also co-edited with Kim McBride and David Polak his Historic Archaeology in Kentucky, published in 1995. He's taught at Georgetown College, Center College, University of Kentucky, Concord University and West Virginia University. Please welcome Dr. Stephen McBride.
Thank you, Ken, for that introduction, and thank you all for being here. Today, I'll give you a brief sort of introduction to the frontier settlement period and the frontier defense, and then really focus on what Ken mentions, our latest research, which is trying to bring more of a community approach to this research, which the booklet we published with the Humanities Council discusses that approach, which focuses on two neighborhoods or communities in the Greenbrier Valley, which are the Muddy Creek neighborhood and the Sinking Creek neighborhood. So we'll talk more about that. Some of you all may know about where that is, and if you don't, I'll show you a map at least twice in the talk. Okay, next. First of all, we need to thank our sponsors, particularly the West Virginia Humanities Council, who obviously brought us here today, and the West Virginia Division of Culture and History. We've gotten grants from them before, and many of these grants we've run through either the Summers County Historic Landmarks Commission or the Greenbrier Historical Society, and also some of our latest research at the McCoy Fort site in Williamsburg has been sponsored or co-sponsored by the Williamsburg District Historical Foundation. Okay, next. Frontier forts in West Virginia are primarily built during or maybe just after major conflicts that have occurred. The first being the French and Indian War, which started really in 1755 and would have mostly affected what's the Potomac Drainage, the Eastern Panhandle of West Virginia. But there had been some settlement in the Western waters, particularly in the Greenbrier Valley and the New River and Tigre Valley. And forts were built there as well. The next major push was in Lord Dunmore's war period, which you will, I'm sure, all of know what Lord Dunmore's war was about. Obviously culminated at the Battle of Point Pleasant in October 1774, and then followed very brief, soon after by the Revolutionary War, in which the vast majority of the Ohio Valley Indians eventually allied with the British and again started raiding the frontier settlements. And the Indian settler warfare in many parts of the state actually continued after the Revolutionary War up until 1794 after the Battle of Fallen Timbers really kind of and the Treaty of Grenville after that, which kind of ended the Native Americans' attempts to reclaim what's now West Virginia and Kentucky, okay? And our area, the Greenbrier Valley, settlement had started there in the late 1740s, early 50s. This was destroyed by the French and Indian War. All the new Euro-American settlers left. Some tried to come back in the early 60s. There was a continuation of the French and Indian War called Pontiac's War in 1763, depopulated it again. Following the treaties of Fort Stanwix and hard labor with the Iroquois and Cherokee, settlers came back into the Greenbrier Valley and they didn't leave again. This was the permanent settlement there. Land conflicts between the settlers and Native Americans started with the lead up to Lord Dunmore's War. The real impetus for this war was really settlement in Kentucky. Surveyors started going into Kentucky. The Shawnee and some other Ohio Valley Indians said, well, you had these treaties with the Cherokee and the Iroquois, but you don't have any treaties with us, and we consider this our land. And this led to Dunmore's War, which ended with a Virginia victory at Point Pleasant. And then things settled down again until the Revolutionary War started in 75. But it wasn't until late 1776, early 77 that Indian raids really started again on the frontier. And during all these periods, forts were built to protect the settlers, okay? And the settlements, the defensive system, which we like to call, as we call it, consisted primarily of three things. One, the county militia, which was an ancient British institution that was brought over here. It was pretty prominent in the 17th century. And then in the early to middle 18th century, it kind of declined because there was a period of relative peace. But after the French and Indian War, it really came back to life and was pretty well organized by the 1770s. And this would be a county organization under the county lieutenant. There'd be a colonel, lieutenant colonel, major, then company officers, and the men, very much like the regular army. Some of these militiamen were designated or volunteered to be what they'd call Indian spies. We might call them scouts now. And they would roam around looking for signs of Indians in the neighborhood, and then they would come back and warn the settlements. The third part of this defensive system is the forts themselves. And these tended to be built and organized by neighborhoods, which the militia company was a neighborhood organization under a captain. And that militia company would garrison those local forts. There's various period documents that talk about the forts, but very few of them actually describe what they look like, what the range of variation was. We have our own idea what a fort might be, but is that the same as their idea of a fort? It's really hard to say. They just call them forts, and I wish they gave us a little bit more description. During this 18th century settlement period, there actually were no towns, so the forts oftentimes served as central places where people would conduct trade. There might be a school, there might be church services, economic exchange, political meetings. Okay. The militia, they usually had terms from, and this comes mostly from Revolutionary War pension applications. A typical service would be 5 to 6 months. Sometimes they would say from the putting out of the leaves in the spring until the fall. And this was also known as the Indian raiding season. During the winter, things were usually fairly peaceful. As I said earlier, people would belong to their neighborhood company under a captain. They would usually do service at their neighborhood fort, but they also could be asked to do longer service or farther away service. Once they left the county, though, by law, they would have to volunteer. They weren't really required to leave the county. Okay. We have, fortunately, some quotes about what this service was like. Here's one from a man named James Gilliland, and he talks about being at Rennick's Fort and then going out and guarding men while they worked on their crops. While some were working, others were watching and guarding, and they would just change positions on that. Again, people were living on isolated farmsteads. They would run to the fort during times of danger, but they didn't want to neglect their farm, so they would go back and try to keep them up. They might eventually actually go back to their cabin, but this was kind of dangerous. Okay.
Question.
Yeah.
Do you have a date on this quote?
This quote, the pension would have been in the 1830s. And I might be able to figure out roughly when he was at Rennick's Fort, but it would have been during the American Revolution. I can't tell you exactly what year, probably 77 to 82, somewhere in that range. Okay. And here's a couple of quotes from Michael Swope, who was living in what's now Monroe County. Gilliland lived up in northern Greenbrier, southern Pocahontas area. And here, when we have a number of these statements of spying, and they'll oftentimes talk about doing this kind of circuit, and he said he would leave Cook's Fort on Indian, go down to the New River, down the New River to the mouth of Bluestone, then to Van Bibber's, which is in Lowell on the Greenbrier River, then to Jarrett's Fort on Wolf Creek, and this circuit was 30 to 35 miles. He would go around looking for Indian signs. Then if he saw some, he would fly from fort to fort and give the alarm so people that were at their cabins could run to the fort. Okay. And that's kind of had this, how this system worked. And in terms of the fort types, or kind of a just hierarchy or typology of forts, we know that some of them were residential, meaning that they were someone's house. This is Andrew Donnelly's house, and it's Andrew Donnelly's fort. It's the same place. What that meant and what it looked like is unclear sometimes. But then we have non-residential forts, and we mean by that they're not someone's house. They're just a fort the militia built out in a strategic location. They were typically stockaded, we believe. The residential forts may have been stockaded, but they also may have been a larger, probably two-story log house, sometimes what we might think of as a blockhouse. So and the stockades themselves probably varied quite a bit in size. But again, we have very few detailed descriptions, okay? Here's a sketch from the Draper manuscripts, which is a period frontier documents as well as interviews and writings that took place in the 19th century. And these were, the originals are up at the Wisconsin Historical Society. This is a man named Spencer Reckers who lived in northern West Virginia. And this was his idea of what a fort, a stockade, looked like, an idealized fort. This is no particular fort. And it's a stockade with two corner bastions. And you can see these bastions. And then here's a description he gave. Okay. And here's a little description of habitation of these forts. How long were these forts occupied? And again, we have James Gilland, and he says that his family would live the whole summer season at the fort, and then in the winter they'd return to their cabin. And Samuel Gwynn, who lived down in what's now Summers County, talks about similar, that the family would live in the summer months at the fort and farm together in common. We also know that some people really didn't like living in the forts, and once the Indian warning had subsided, they just go back to their cabin. Those were the people that oftentimes got killed, but you know, it would get kind of crowded and unpleasant in the forts, you know, for a long period of time, so you can kind of understand. And some of you all may have heard of the Indian attack at the James Graham house in the Summers County. That's what happened. They were down at Van Bibber's Fort across the river, and James Graham said, "Oh, I'm kind of tired here. I'm going to go back to the house. Anyone want to go with me?" And some people did. And the next day, the house was attacked. And I don't recall exactly, but 2, 3, 4 people were killed. Okay, next. In the Greenbrier Valley, which, as Ken said, we've been working on for about 25 years, I guess. It's kind of shocking. But I would have been a young man when this started. But we found evidence of, during the Revolutionary period, of at least 32 forts that we have primary documentation of. And they're on this map. And we have Pocahontas down to Summers. You don't have to remember where they are or anything. But there's a lot of forts. And all through the state, particularly on the New River Valley, the Greenbrier, the Tigert, West Fork, Monongahela, and then in the Northern Panhandle, there would have been a similar density of forts in the Revolutionary War era. Obviously, in the Eastern Panhandle and the Potomac, there would have been a similar density in the French and Indian War period. And then later, as settlers moved up towards this area, there were forts built in the 1780s and 1790s, like Fort Lee here. Go ahead. And as I said a minute ago, that we've just kind of had a shift this last couple of years and tried to look at more detail in a couple of communities, being Sinking Creek and Muddy Creek in Greenbrier, looking at more detail into the militia records, looking at land surveys, seeing where people lived, looking at other documents. There's no censuses for that era, but we have tax records, particularly records called tithable lists, and they're kind of the closest thing we have to a census, okay? And here's a map. This is Greenbrier County in present day, and here's Lewisburg, or what was Fort Savannah at that time. And then Seeking Creek's up here, kind of in the central part of the county, and then Muddy Creek is in the southern, and it actually flows out into the river at Alderson, if some of you all may have heard of Alderson. Okay. And you don't have to read these charts, but these are basically our compilation of everything we know economically, land ownership-wise, of the people in the two communities. And they're mostly from tithable lists from 1775, when we would have been Botetourt County, and then the 1783 tax list. And another thing we've looked at is the families themselves, and found that a lot of these families migrated in groups of extended families. People had married together. They're mostly coming from the upper James River Valley around the cow pasture, calf pasture, Jackson River Valley, and some of them directly from Ireland. But the vast majority that were from Virginia had come from Ireland, or what we would call Northern Ireland today. They were Scots Presbyterians originally, some Northern English, some Welsh, and then a real smattering of others, including people of German or Dutch extraction, the Van Bibber family. In particular, but we also were in contact with a number of descendants that had done genealogy that was really quite helpful to us. Okay. Here's our research on the tithables and forts, and from this you can get an idea of about how many forts there were in the Greenbrier Valley and how many people were living there. And Muddy Creek and Sinking, our research has suggested that each of those had three forts. We have mention of three forts in each of those valleys, and there were 42 tithables, and that tithables would have been adult men, basically. Okay. Another thing we've done research on, which I mentioned, was the militia themselves. This is mostly from order books, county order books. And you can see in 1774, we have seven different companies. These would have each been under a captain for the Greenbrier. It's not the Greenbrier Valley, it would be the lower valley. It would be what later became Greenbrier County, which would include southern Pocahontas down through Summers. But it doesn't include central and northern Pocahontas County, which stayed in Augusta County and then became Bath County, then Pocahontas County. Yeah. But anyway, you can see as population grew, there became more and more militia companies, and areas were subdivided. For instance, the Sinking Creek started out as being Sinking and Spring Creek together. And then were split off. And Andrew Donnelly and William McCoy will be names that I'll mention later in the talk. Some of you all maybe have heard of Captain Robert McClanahan because he was killed at the Battle of Point Pleasant. And then Muddy Creek was originally under Matthew Arbuckle and included a broader area, and then later under Captain William Hamilton, who I'll mention a little bit more later. Some of you all may have heard of Arbuckle because he was the leader of the scout that led Andrew Lewis's troops up from Camp Union, which is Lewisburg now, up to Point Pleasant. He's also an ancestor of Joseph Jeffords, who was a sponsor of our work there as well. Okay. I mentioned some of the duties of the militia, garrison, the forts, ranging, spying, and also guarding crop work. And through the Draper manuscripts and the pension, we also know they did quite a bit of service outside of the area. Point Pleasant, they were garrisoned at Fort Randolph, marched to Fort Pitt, went on expeditions in pretty far-reaching areas for that time. Okay. At the end of both Dunmore's War and the Revolutionary War, citizens could make public claims. Unfortunately, these are extant. And this shows some of the other things that both militia as well as other citizens made claims for: driving cattle, guarding prisoners, loaning horses, providing food both for themselves and others, and then supplying what ultimately was food to forage. One interesting thing we found is pretty much beef, mutton, and venison were the meats that they would mention, but the majority of meats we're finding archaeologically are actually pork. Go ahead. Another thing we looked at was the wealth of the fort owners. And as you can see from the means here, the fort owners' builders are quite a bit wealthier than your average citizens. And some of the forts I'm going to mention today are Donnelly's, Arbuckle's, Hamilton's, McCoy's. And you can see Andrew Donnelly, who later actually moved up here to the Kanawha Valley and became involved in the salt industry, was a quite wealthy individual. One thing we tried to do in the neighborhoods was piece together who was the commander at each of those three forts. Usually the commanders, for instance, at Arbuckle's was the local captain, either Arbuckle himself or William Hamilton. But there's a few occasions where outside captains and their companies were garrisoning those forts. This is quite interesting, a guy from Botetourt. Donnelly's is particularly interesting because, as some of you all may know, there was a major battle at Fort Donnelly in May of 1778, and this led to all kinds of communication going on and the sending additional troops or militia to the Greenbrier Valley from nearby counties, including Botetourt County, Bedford County, and other places that were pretty far away. But this gives us an idea also that Donnelly's Fort and Arbuckle's Fort are mentioned a lot more than the other two forts, Feimster's and Hamilton's here, and McCoy's and Mudfort here. And this starts making us think that maybe these three forts aren't all the same. Maybe Arbuckle's is a bigger fort and Donnelly's is a bigger fort and the other four are smaller forts. And in fact, during the attack on Donnelly's, William Hamilton took his militia half company that was stationed at his fort, Hamilton's, and said, "We're leaving here, this fort's too little," and we moved up to Arbuckle's. So we know from that there is quite a bit of difference in what these forts look like. And we're thinking that Arbuckle's, which is sometimes also called Keeney's Fort, and Donnelly's were the big forts, okay? And the archaeology will kind of confirm this. This again shows some of the wealth differences that the militia leaders, top 10% of the county owned considerably more than 10% of the wealth, and particularly Andrew Donnelly, who owned 90% of the slaves in the Sinking Creek area. Okay, I'm going to archaeology finally. What are we up to with the archaeology? Well, here's some questions we're interested in. As I mentioned, the descriptions of the forts usually aren't very detailed, so we want to know what they look like. Another is what kind of material culture are we going to find, and how does this help us understand the people's life ways? And we're going to put this in this context of this community approach. Okay. In terms of methods, here's some of the methods we use. As Ken mentioned, we have to kind of start out finding the sites, or we're not going to do much else until we do. And really, the number one way we found these sites is talking to people. And they'll say, well, do you know where Arbuckle's Fort is? Well, yeah, it's over here. And you find sort of the county historian, and then we do archival research. Then we go out to the site, do metal detecting, and excavate small holes we call shovel test pits or STPs. And then if the site looks good for that, we might go back and dig larger excavation units. This is actually a picture of Arbuckle's Fort. And this is Muddy Creek here and Mill Creek coming in there. Another thing we might look for are terrain keys or clues to, is this a place that has water? Is this a place that's defendable? So we might look at some terrain issues too, okay. There's three forts that we've excavated on. In the two valleys, each of which again had three forts, Donnelly's, McCoy's, and Mud in Sinking Creek. These are the militia captains of the Sinking Creek area. McClanahan got killed, Donnelly got promoted to colonel eventually, and McCoy became the captain. He was actually the lieutenant under McClanahan and was up at Point Pleasant. And then Muddy, Arbuckle, and then Hamilton and Feimser had the forts. Arbuckle's fort actually was on John Keeney's property, not on his own property. And then he and Hamilton were the captains of that region, and Hamilton was the captain for most of the period. Yeah.
What's the Todd's, Mr. Rod?
I'm sorry.
What's the Tithes word mean up there next to the 42 and down the other
side? Oh, it's tithes.
Okay.
Or tithe is a taxable person.
Oh, okay.
And
so
it's
usually like the same thing as a church when you give your offering.
Right, okay. Right. It's it, and they. Right. Yeah. It's that they're important documents for us because they're. The tithable list, they call them, and they make a list of adult men, usually. They'll actually have widows listed, too. But married women don't get on there except as a number. But they're nice because they're organized by stream valley, so we can guess where they were roughly, and then we can kind of hone in on them.
Children weren't counted either?
No, they don't. They'll give, like, if a man is listed, and then it'll usually say tithes, it'll usually say one. But sometimes it'll say two or three, which means he has himself and two adult sons. And then if the widows are there, they'll say tithe, and there'll be zero. But they'll have her name there. But it's adult men, basically, from the 1800s. I mean, 1700s. Sure, go ahead. Next slide. Okay. Nope, you're going backwards. Oops, go back one. Yeah, okay. Yeah, thank you. Here's the forts again, and I'll talk about two in the Sinking Creek Valley, and Sinking Creek actually includes Sinking Creek and what used to be called Little Sinking or Raiders Run now. And this was considered a neighborhood. Another aspect of the militia company that I didn't mention was that they had broader functions besides just military. That was the tax collection unit. The captain would be in charge of that. It would be the road building or maintenance unit. They would supervise road maintenance within that neighborhood. For instance, there's a description of the road from Camp Union to Donnelly's to McCoy's, which the road is more or less still there today. Okay. Donnelly's Fort is located in Raiders Valley. This is a USGS topographic map showing the location. It's easier to find these forts if there's monuments on them. though the monument isn't exactly necessarily right in the fort, but this one is. And this is on a farm property by named John Johnson owns it, and his mother was a raider, and Andrew Donnelly sold this farm to Anthony Raider when he left in the 1780s. So this farm is in the second family that ever owned it, after Native Americans. there's Andrew Donnelly, okay. Donnelly's is unique in our area because of the attack. It's the only one we really have descriptions of what the fort looked like. It was attacked by anywhere from 100 to 300 Native Americans. They came in a late siege to Fort Randolph, first at Point Pleasant. That was unsuccessful, so they moved up the Kanawha River. At the Meadow River, they got off there and cut across over the Greenbrier Valley and attacked Donnelly's Fort on May 29th. The attack was unsuccessful. It was extremely unsuccessful because 17 Indians were killed, which is a terribly large number for them. The fort was garrisoned, we know, by 20 militia, and there were 60 women and children in there. And then it was reinforced in the afternoon by 66 more militia that were came from Fort Savannah, which is Lewisburg. The attack lasted most of the day, and then after that, we know they broke up into smaller groups and attacked other cabins and also McCoy's Fort, which is located a little north of there. Okay. These descriptions of the fort really helped us figure it out because we found an architectural evidence of Donnelly's house. Actually, we didn't find it. Mr. Johnson's cows found it. They uncovered some stones scratching around, you know how cows are, and he called us up and said, the cows uncovered some stones, and you can see this is actually snow. It was in the winter, so we came rushing out there and exposed some of the stones and said, well, can we come back in the spring? He said, sure. So we came back, and we exposed this double chimney. There's a hearth on this side, a smaller hearth, and then there's a bigger hearth on this side. So it would have been a central chimney in a building. Next. And this is really important because John Stewart said the house composed one part of the front of the fort and was double, the kitchen making one end of the house, and there Hammond and the Negro were. The firing of Hammond and Dick awakened the people at the other end of the house upstairs. So the house was one part or the front of the fort, and the larger hearth is no doubt the kitchen where Philip Hammond and Dick Pointer, who was an enslaved man of Andrew Donnelly's, were and fought off the initial attack. So this led us to think, okay, the house was really the front of the fort. If it was stockaded, the stockade would have run into the house. Okay, next. So we kind of guesstimated about how big the house was and then went out farther from that and started digging trenches. And it's probably hard for you all to see, but can you see there's kind of a darker stain right here? And there's actually a little one here. This is a post, And this is what we thought actually was a stockade trench for the fort. And next. So we got a little track hoe, and we started following out that stain. This is me, and this is actually Mr. Johnson, the landowner here. Okay. And sure enough, it is a stockade. It goes right off through here. Here's Dave Dobbins, one of our volunteers. It takes a corner there. Here's a bisection of the stockade, which shows a post here, and then the stockade trench itself, which are usually about a foot and a half wide, and then have posts stuck in it. Okay, next. We kept following it and found a bastion, a rectangular, remember that Spencer Records map in one corner here. Actually, I'm jumping ahead, but here's a map of it. That's that bastion right there. And it has little posts in it, probably to support a platform of scaffolding up above to fire off of. Okay. Here's the north bastion. Again, there's a dark stain here, which was a stockade trench. Okay. A number of pit features, too. Some smaller pits. This is the stockade here, one of the corners. And there's two pits there. And then that's a big cellar behind the house. Okay. Here's bisections of those two pit features. Okay. And then here's an aerial photo of the fort itself. There's the chimney. So Donnelly's house was here. There's the north bastion and south bastion, and there's those pits. And there's Raiders Run right there. Okay. And then there's the map of it. And you can see the two pin log house, the chimney, the cellar, and then the stockade. This is about 92 by 87 feet, something like that. The gate would have been right here. So this is one of the first forts that we ever got an idea of what it looked like. Okay. And here's some artifacts from there.
I was just going to add,
we're
about like 25 people here. Just think back to those records, 60 people were living in this. It's really small.
They might have been in the house, or maybe they set up some lean-tos or tent-type structures. We just don't know, but it would have been really crowded.
Question.
Yeah.
So, based on your statement earlier, Dick Pointer and Hammond were in the house shooting out at the Indians initially?
Flip back. They were right in here in the kitchen half. And the other militia were upstairs asleep. This was a two-story building. Uh-huh. And what happened is a man named Pritchett left here, went down to the creek to gather wood, and left the door of the kitchen open. The Indians killed him down here, and they saw that door was open. I imagine they kind of thought about it for a minute. And then they rushed that door, which was unusual for them to do. And Hammond and Pointer shot at them. And they were, then it awakened the men upstairs. They started shooting at the Indians. Men moved into the bastion, started shooting. But there were apparently 17 killed right out here.
So that big gun at the Greenbrier Historical Society probably was not the gun that Dick Pointer.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Yeah. I don't think he was toting that thing around.
Right,
the
right. That's a wall gun, which is.
So it would have been more likely to have been fixed on one of those bastions.
Yeah, that would have been fixed. He probably had a regular size rifle or musket, and he said he loaded up with swan shot, is mostly. And anyway, you're right. Yeah. Okay. there's the key to the fort. But the ceramics are mostly, they're a mix of English ceramics, which suggest, pretty decent trade connections, as well as redware, red earthenware that could have been either local or made in the Shenandoah Valley, which would have been more utilitarian, whereas wrought iron nails are a common artifact. And then clothing items like shoe buckles or buttons. And then we've got a couple of musket balls, and I'll mention more when we get to arbuckles, but the musket balls and the gun flints from these sites suggest they were mostly using 40 to 50 caliber rifled muskets, which would have been hunting weapon size. They're not using military 70, 69, 70 caliber French or Brown Bess type smoothbores. So they're, which is what you kind of expect because they're militia, they're bringing their own supplies. The government isn't really supplying them. Okay. Oh, okay. McCoy's Fort, I got to speed up here. McCoy's Fort, another fort in Greenbrier in the Sinking Creek area. Not mentioned as much as Donnelly, but is really important because it was still standing. It was inside a barn, and it became a kind of preservation emergency. It was listed as one of the most endangered sites in the state. Money was raised. The barn that surrounded it became very unstable. Money was raised to take the barn down and then take the two-story log house down. And the logs are stored at present to be hopefully reconstructed. And while they, after they were taken down, we got a grant to go in and do excavation. Initially, all the way around the house, you can see the house here with the help of Boy Scouts. And then we came back and excavated the inside with the help of, I believe, eighth graders.
Yeah, the entire eighth grade in Greenbrier.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead. And here's a couple of cellar features that were inside the house. Okay. Excavated out. Okay. And one thing we found from this excavation was that the east side of the house had a lot more trash in it than the west side. And this usually indicates the backyard. People tend to keep their front yard cleaner, which makes sense here because of the view to the west is down the valley, and it allowed us to figure out the orientation of the building. Okay. We also looked to see if it, like Fort Donnelly, had a stockade. So we dug trenches with a small track hoe and did not find any evidence of it. So we feel pretty confident that this was not stockaded, that it was just a two-story log house, but they referred to it as a fort, and it was garrisoned because it was just a larger structure owned by a militia officer, a prominent man in the community. Here's some artifacts similar to the Donnelly ones, including similar sized musket balls and gun flints. Most of the gun flints we find are these honey colored, which are from France. Okay, some more clothing items, including a lice comb, there's bone, smoking pipe, and a nice little glass bead. Okay, and the final site is Arbuckle's Fort, which is actually the most extensively excavated. Again, it's easier to find them if they have monuments. And this monument, unfortunately, here's Kim here, is right on top of the chimney of what turns out from the foundation, we think, is a blockhouse. And this is an artist's reconstruction of it. And we think that because of the small size of the foundation relative to the chimney. Okay. We found a number of cellars or pit features, some of which we think are likely under buildings, large circular refuse pit, which had a tremendous amount of animal bone. We also hit a stockade here, initially in a test unit that these two students were digging in. Here's some bisections of that, showing similar depth and post-moles. This one's interesting in that it shows these posts have sprouted, that they were green when they were put in. Okay. Again, like at Donnelly, we followed it out with a backhoe in this situation. One thing we found, we started here is where we found it, and then it teed here. So we found out that this something weird going on. It was, and it turns out the upper one was the main stockade. Again, like Donnelly, we found a bastion, a gate, okay. Here's an aerial photo, two bastion fort, like Spencer Records drew. This one's about 110 feet on a side with the blockhouse here, and then, go ahead, these strange internal stockade lines. Again, this was the first one we found, and we followed it down here. It has a little mini bastion or redan, and then goes here, and then there's, go back, another one up here. Okay, next. And here's an artist's reconstruction of it without this other short line, because that would be block all the buildings. And one of the questions we have, was this all contemporaneous, or were these shorter stockades earlier? Go ahead. Here's some artifacts, wrought nails, shoe buckles and other buckles, cast iron kettle, scissors, go ahead. Some coins, bottle glass and ceramics, which are very rare. Arbuckles is a militia fort and not a residential house fort. So the amount of ceramics and glass is much less than at Donnelly's or at McCoy's. Faunal material, animal bones suggest majority identified is pig, and second is white-tailed deer. Here's arms artifacts, drop balls, and then spired balls. And Arbuckles was actually the site of two battles, one in 1774 and one in 77. More of these French gun flints. Okay. Also, we found evidence of locally made gun flints out of local church. Okay. And by analyzing these bullets and the gun flints, we think because of their position, here's drop balls, and then the S are spent balls, which are mostly along this wall and this wall, that the Indian attacks were coming mostly from the north. Okay, next one. And then the position of the gun flints as well, the French ones here, and then the French and gray European here, makes us, it suggests that these lines were manned and some drop balls were found there. And because the gray ones are really, the gray ones are earlier than the French ones, that we're tending to think that these stockade lines here were actually an early period of the fort, probably the 1774 fort, and then it was expanded in 1775, 76. But we'll have to keep doing more work there to find out. Okay. Another artifact we found, two artifacts that we have real interesting are this X inscribed brass rivet. And these X symbols have been found a lot on African American sites. Okay, go. And may represent what's called a Bi-Congo cosmogram. These have been found on slave cabin sites in particular, okay? And we actually found a second one with another grant we had from the Humanities Council, okay? Another artifact we found is this seal or cuff link that says Liberty on it. And this reminds us that the battle at Fort Arbuckle, or the war that these people were fighting, was not just a settler Indian war, but it was part of the American Revolution. And Matthew Arbuckle, in fact, said, "Give this last, I would give my last ounce of my blood for that precious commodity called liberty." Okay. And I want to mention we did another little project this year at Fort Blair, at Point Pleasant, and we did a survey there hoping to find some evidence of the fort at the park. And we basically didn't find any definite evidence of the fort. We found some 18th century artifacts, but there's also a house slash tavern mansion there at the park, and the artifacts could come from that. But it's possible that some of them, particularly a shoe buckle and a lead artifact, might be from the fort, but more work will be necessary there. And we want to thank all our volunteers that have helped, including adults and school children. There's some of them shown here. And concluding thoughts, the neighborhood focus has really helped, and I'll just end it there because I've gone a little over. So if anyone has any questions, and thank our sponsors again. Yeah?
What are your thoughts on the Spanish coin that was found at before in our house?
That's really not uncommon. Specie or coinage was very rare on the frontier, and Spanish coins actually were legal in the United States until the 1840s. So it's just a silver coin. It being from Spain doesn't really make any difference versus France. We didn't make any coinage ourselves that early, and some sites you'll find British, but the silver seemed to be more popular, and you notice those were cut up. They're cut them for change. They're reals or two reals, most of the ones we found. Another question? Yeah?
What makes the anomaly of the darker stain as opposed to the contrast?
It's an organic decomposition. There's more organic matter, whether it be wood or plant matter or like animal bones that's thrown away. Like some of those pit features were darker because the settlers had thrown trash in them, which decomposed and it'll stain the soil. The stockade line was a mix between what they would do is they dig a trench and they're digging through the topsoil and digging into the subsoil. Then they put vertical posts in there, and then they throw the dirt back. And when it goes back in, it's mixed up. So it has some topsoil and subsoil mix. But when you get down to the subsoil, which is a yellowish-brown clay, you can really see the difference. And then the posts themselves, if they rot, they leave a darker stain within that trench because they're more organic.
Is there a depth?
Well, these sites have all been plowed, so we can't see any features until we get down about a foot because of the plow zone, and then after that, the stockades go down about another foot after that. So there may have been a certain amount of erosion up there, but I can't really estimate what that might have been. Okay, any other? Yeah, one more.
When you finish your excavations, your study, how do you leave the site? Do you cover it back up?
We do. We cover it back up, and we try to leave it as close to how we got it, found it, as we can. If we're going to come back, sometimes we'll put a little piece of plastic down at the bottom to protect where we stopped and help us relocate it again. But we backfill everything and put the sod back on too. We usually take the sod off separately.
Except that sometimes the cows come and eat the sod.
Yeah. So sometimes the farmers say, don't bother, we'll just reseed it. Okay, yeah.
Is there any likelihood that any of these sites would eventually be restored in some way or reconstructed in some way?
Just really the McCoy's Fort, and they likely are, it seems like now if they reconstruct it, it's not going to be on the original site. It might be at a museum area. there's those historic markers at those other two and a number of other sites in the valley, but you know, we basically spend a lot of time developing a relationship with farmers, and they allow us to come there, and so we kind of want to follow their desires. If some of them would bring that up, we might, you know, follow through with that, but I'd be better if they would bring it up.
What about if they want to preserve it?
Well, they are preserving it now. All of those landowners are very cooperative in preserving the site, but you know, they still have operating farms. They might allow us to put some more historic markers up, but except for McCoy's again, I don't think there's been any discussion of, you know, reconstructing a fort or anything like that.
Yeah, the one at the Germany Valley, there were markers put up there after the work, right?
Right. Yeah, there's a nice stone marker at the Hinkle's Fort site in Pendleton County. Some of the markers have been improved, and we also... There was a move, two of the French and Indian forts we worked on, which were Fort Edwards and Cape and Bridge, and Fort Ashby. There's talk of reconstructing those and preserving those. And actually, Fort Edwards, there's a museum and there's a section of stockade wall that has been reconstructed. Those are two French and Indian War period forts that are, you know, close to a major road, the US 50 there. One of the issues with both Fort Donnelly and Arbuckle's Fort is they're pretty far off the beaten track. You kind of have to want to go there. And I might acknowledge a person in the back, David Rotenizer. Stand up, David. Who actually worked with us on our very first fort survey, when we were all young people. So, but David didn't have any hair. Sorry, David.
It was a lot closer to the frontier period when these guys started. They had the advantages. Stephen, thank you so much. I was so pleased you mentioned Joe Jeffords. Joe was...
Yeah.
Major patron of the archaeology in his lifetime, also a major donor to the purchase of this house. He was president of the Humanities Council when we acquired this property. This is the Jeffords Room, so thank you. I've been to the Arbuckle site with Joe and also to Arbuckle House in Lewisburg, where he partly grew up. His grandparents were there. Thank you all. Thank you, Steve, Kim. Thanks to everybody. We have refreshments in the next room, so don't leave now, but you're free to stand up. Thank you.